From Raleigh, North Carolina, it's Westworld with J-Jack and Mike, a podcast dedicated to HBO's Westworld. This week we will dissect, recap, and analyze episode 2.3, Virtue e Fortuna. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. Everybody, and welcome to Westworld with Jay, Jack, and Mike. My name is Jay.
My name is Mike.
And I'm the Eye of the Tiger.
Okay. Yeah, I guess so.
Well, what else was there in this episode?
I mean, there's plenty of things in there.
Weasel Teddy. I don't know.
Weasel Teddy.
He weaseled out of killing the person, and someone's not happy about that.
All right.
What else was there?
No, I mean, there's.
Go ahead. You could be, I don't know, Lee Sizemore's discarded hat. Eye of the Tiger, I guess, makes sense. Now it's just, unfortunately, just like the glassy Eye of the Tiger, considering that it is now waterlogged. But I understand it. At least I understood this one, unlike my denseness last week.
I can't remember which one it was last week, but...
That was
a week ago.
Before we get into the actual recap for this episode, which is it Virtue, but it's Virtue e Fortuna, or is it like Virtue, but it's a distorted, just in reading it? Is there any significance in the name? Mike, do you have any significance for the name of this episode?
Now, I was trying to look into it, and I couldn't find anything. If you Google Virtue e Fortuna, it looks like... From what I read, it's a reference to the theories of influential Renaissance philosopher Niccolo Machiavelli. So you know, it's not exactly like a piece of music like the Well-Tempered Clavier was last season, but this one is more so known about Machiavelli. So maybe that means that we're turning more so from this sort of artistic beauty that exists in season one to this harder. I mean, we get so many war analogies and references in this episode that we're turning more towards strategy. And especially, I feel like Dolores is very Machiavellian in this episode, considering that, you know, we were wondering when are things going to break. And when we see the Ghost Nation memories saying that, oh, when is Dolores going to end up turning against the host? Isn't she going to want to rally all the hosts together? No, she just wants to get what she wants. And she doesn't matter how many hosts or humans she kills to get where she wants to go. So I feel like Virtue Fortuna definitely, I feel like, applies to Dolores, though. I'm sure as we talk as well, it could apply to, I don't know, Maeve manipulating, you know, getting her sort of army going. It could be about, you know, them manipulating
army,
Abernathy to get the information into him. There's a lot of different things that we can apply this principle to.
Yes. But before we get into the recap for this episode, we have something that is developed called hashtag Fartgate. last week on the podcast, episode like 40, last week's episode at minute 46, somewhere around there, there is seemingly just out of nowhere a very active fart sound in the audio. And
which Ethan was the first one to point that out. He sent me a thing.
He listens for that.
I go, well, it wasn't me, so because I would own up to it. I don't care.
I was like, what? There's no way. And listen to it. There was definitely a fart like sound, almost like comically a farting noise, a flatulent noise. So if you noticed it last week, it's there. It's a real thing. And this weekend for our kind of podcast get together, it was the hot topic of night one.
Yes. Oh man, that sounds. I feel bad for everyone else who was just like, why are they talking about farts?
Well, it was like probably 2 a.m. and no joke, this got to like JFK assassination levels of theorizing.
Oliver Stone's going to make a movie about it.
They took the audio, they slowed it down. They're trying to listen for pauses in our voices to try and pick out, you know, which podcaster was it. And at different points throughout the night, it was, oh, it's definitely Mike, or oh, it's definitely Jack, or oh, it's definitely Jay. So it got to the point I was like, guys, there's no way one of us farted. I would have heard it when it happened.
Unless you
Jack would own up to it. We have mutes on our mics, so it's got to be something else. So we went to the master file And we actually, I went to the original file, the uncompressed file, and listened to it. And this is my final answer on it. There, the conspiracy theorists of our podcasting community are still kind of running wild with it. But it actually, in the original uncompressed, you know, master file, it sounds like a digital distortion on Mike's Skype, which happens from time to time.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. Because I would have, to be honest, I mean, we're open people here. I probably would have owned up to it as well. It's a natural bodily function. But yeah, that does happen sometimes with like the board that I'm using. Sometimes it has these little like buzzes. So I guess it could be construed as that. I haven't taken the time to listen to it, but from what you're saying, you did the research and you dug back into the unedited files. Yes. I think that makes sense.
And it sounds more digital there, but when it got compressed and levelated and all of that, it sounds just like almost a stinger fart sound.
Because I wasn't there during the debate, was people saying, like, is it a magic fart?
Or they were just like, or
back,
was,
yeah, and to the left.
It was like, is Jack, you know, lifting up back and to the left? There's a lot of theories that are going on.
It stops in midair.
Most of the people did not take my answer as gospel. They want to keep theorizing.
Most people I talked to, because I said, look, I would own up to it. I don't care. I'm old. Sometimes they just, you know, at my age, you can just be, they just sleep out. But I said that most people think it's you, Jay.
I know, and that's fine. Hey, listen,
because you're going to such an effort to disprove.
I looked at it scientifically, and that is, as the producer of the show, that is my scientific conclusion. Take it as you will.
I'm just imagining a very similar moment to like when Bernard found whatever was encrypted in Abernathy's file, where you're like, oh my God, it goes much deeper than you think.
Well, like I broke down the waveform image of the audio, and I showed how way the audio, the waveform looked, it did not look like a natural sound. There's visual evidence, there's audio evidence.
I just thought about this. Shouldn't that be a new T-shirt on the Jane Jack Teespring account? Fartgate.
We'll leave it to the listeners.
I think that's a fantastic idea.
A separate, maybe on the Ramblecast, we can break it down even more. But there you go. There's the response to last week's podcast episode. And the controversial Fartgate.
You know, it's almost like when we were doing Lost. We come up with something we thought was really exciting, but it'd be something stupid we said that everybody would respond to. So last week I thought it was pretty good conversation. And what is everyone talking about? A fart.
It's art. Art is a fascinating thing.
Art with an F.
All right. That is that. Let's jump into this episode. There's beauty in who we are. Shouldn't we too try to survive? We have a cold open in India land.
What do you call this, a cold open, or do we call this like a fourth of the episode? Yeah. At what minute mark does it cross into no longer being a cold open and just a pre-credit scene?
That's true. I mean, I guess it is a pre-title credit scene, but it's just that's so much of what we kind of seem to think of as pre-credits. But that's a good call out. It was at least 10 minutes, right? It was a long opening.
Like 12
it
was his own 13 minutes. Yeah,
it was its own episode.
We have.
Yeah, I could see in another universe if Westworld came out like 10 years ago. You better believe that Rajland, which I think is the official name of it, would have its own like between the two seasons. They would be like webisodes about the adventures in Rajland of this unnamed guest. Who I think the official casting has been listed as Grace, and then this guy, this other guy who died,
who is a older Skarsgård brother, I believe. So Westworld is the show in which lesser-known older siblings to famous action or, you know, actors get a spot on Westworld.
Would this have been a park you guys would want to attend?
Yeah, I think so. Well, I think maybe for the big game hunters and stuff like that.
It's not something I'd want to do. I wouldn't want to go.
But you're more of a meat and potatoes.
I don't want to go kill animals. Kind of I mean, I don't. Killing other humans is different, but killing animals, I don't.
Well, what if they're robots? Because that's sort of the opening thing here with the two guests we're sort of talking about is they're sort of echoing, I think, a lot of the sentiments of the guests in the first season, which was like, who cares? These are robots. They don't really feel anything. And they sort of get their own taste of it. And we'll get into it, but it's interesting to sort of now see this play out. Like, we were wondering, was this just limited to Westworld? But it seems like now things are starting to spread across all the parks.
Well, yes. Right. And there's, and it does echo kind of what the whole point of the park is. You know, if there are no like real ramifications to your actions, what kind of person would you be? And, you know, if there is no ramifications of killing these robot animals, but you still get the thrill of hunting a very dangerous animal, you know, is it, you know, is it wrong? So the other Skarsgård bro falls for the strong brunette who is named Grace. We never get that from the characters in the show. At this park to hunt Bangles. They play a shooting game. So there's kind of this, is one of them a host? The whole time I was thinking she was a host, and that was...
Agreed. It's because we were used to when, you know, Angela was giving that pitch to Logan, mm-hmm. where it was like the same thing of, oh, you're a human. Oh, wait, you're a host the entire time. I think that's what we were thinking. And I thought it was going to be, again, if we were going with this much shorter cold open idea, that they would be playing around in the bedroom and she would shoot him and she'd actually shoot him because she's a host and now she has the capability to kill him.
Yep.
Yeah. I kept saying, run, dude. Cause I thought she was a host also.
They then go on a hunting quest to, and it's complete with the elephants that they're riding on. Now here's the thing. There's a lot of things about, you know, riding elephants around. Those were real elephants. I don't know the ethical ramifications of shooting it, but
I think it's how they're treated. The elephants, some are treated.
Yeah, I don't know how if Raj Land is above Barnum and Bailey Circus, but let's hope that they are in those days. I mean, it takes place, I guess, relatively soon afterwards. I mean, now we're starting to get some. What I will say is, you know, Westworld season 2 has been sprinkling in some mysteries, but obviously has not let forth the dam of mysteries like season 1 did. But I don't know if you guys saw what Miss Grace was like doodling in her notebook a little bit.
Yes,
but an interesting symbol.
Does it relate to anything, or is she just trying to map out the park to where she can find the Bengal tigers?
Well, here's the thing that I noticed. So the symbol, it seemed like two intersecting hexagons, which we got. I did not screen cap when Bernard got into Abernathy's file, but I'm pretty sure in the bottom right corner of that tablet was that same symbol. Huh. So I don't know what that means. My leading theory right now, and sorry to steal your thunder a bit here, Jack, in our old little cold open here, is I believe that this woman, Grace, is a board member of some sort. Because I think that, you know, when this guy found her, she was like off by herself sitting at a table. Like, I feel like people usually don't really go to like Westworld or to any of these worlds alone. You know, I feel like they go for more of the experience. So it feels like she knows the lay of the land, and maybe she's sort of in cahoots with Charlotte or pursuing something similar to Charlotte, where she's trying to do things for more nefarious purposes, and maybe that's how the hexagon symbols are connected, or maybe she's in search of that hexagon symbol. I'm not entirely sure, but that's what I noticed as a nice bookend to the episode.
Well, it's something she's keeping secret, because when the guy first sits down next to her, they give a shot of her with her hand on the book, and she's got her hand on the little notebook, and when she's looking at it, he comes walking when they go to the camp. Get off the elephants. She's looking at it. He walks over. She quickly closes it and puts it away. So she's not sharing the information with anybody. True. Whatever she's writing down. So you could be right about that.
They get there and there's no hosts around. Grace kind of sees some dead people. The elder Skarsgård kind of doesn't really see the problem for what it is, and again, if Grace is a board member, she knows that something is wrong. Their guide turns on them, kills Skarsgård. Grace escapes, but is hunted down by a tiger. She ends up getting to the edge of Raj Land gets past the park border. The tiger follows. She tries to shoot the tiger, hitting it on its side. But it is she is tackled into the lake, which closes to the or goes into the opening titles. My question here is: should this have opened the season? It kind of the two sequence bits that we had of Grace's story in this, I thought lost some of its punch by not. I think it's been kind of cooler to open the season because we would be expecting to be here, and it's like, what? You know, or we were expecting Shogun Land, but to open with a completely different land, I don't know. I thought it was just something worth mentioning to you.
Or would it be like when season two of The Leftovers opened and people were like, who the hell is this?
Yeah.
What happened to all these characters? Maybe they were afraid of that they really wanted to, because we ended on such an action-packed moment in season one. They want to sort of cut right back to that chase, right. Even though it does admittedly open a little slow with, you know, Bernard / Arnold and Dolores talking. But yeah, it's weird to sort of have episode three just randomly open on this. It makes you feel like you almost tuned to the wrong channel accidentally. I also did notice that the guy, Ganju, before he shoots at them, he says these violent delights have violent ends. So again, to what I spoke before about, you know, maybe this being more of a less a park-wide thing and more of like a land-wide thing, considering that, yes, that's sort of like the mantra of Dolores, but those words came from Arnold. Those were his last words before Dolores kills him. So do we think that his influence has sort of seeped into other things in the park too?
Absolutely.
I think so, 100%.
Absolutely. And I guess there's no way to do it well or to not have it be kind of jarring. But to me, I feel like your time to be jarring is in episode one. I think it's still it's an interesting opening to the park, expanding to an area that we didn't know existed. But again, I think seeing the dead tiger already kind of made us feel like, oh, this is another park we don't even know about beyond what we've seen before. So I feel like they may have taken away some of their I don't want to say shock, but a bit of a surprise. It kind of got spoiled a little bit by their own story or how they've organized their timelines.
The guy looked like he shot him in the same spot that Grace, the mark where he was shot by Grace. When he gets shot by the guy, it looks like it's almost the same exact spot where Grace shot him and left that mark on his.
I wonder if that made it hurt worse because he already had like a bruise there. It's like, ah, yes. Right.
So maybe.
I mean, and that's the thing too is that like, I mean, she left him, so she probably assumed he's dead. Who knows if he was though?
I don't think he's dead.
He might be the Bill of Rajland, like has a secret supply in that tent with all those dead bodies of medicinal equipment.
Also, if you're Grace and a tiger's chasing after you, do you just not make the jump?
You mean jump off the cliff?
Jump off into the water? I mean, you got a tiger.
Pretty rocky. Yeah, I mean, it's risky.
Well,
I mean, if you were dexterous, I would say try to do like a juke, and when the tiger dives for you, like try to dive out of the way. But admittedly, there's a lot of force coming at you.
Yeah, I think shoot and duck would have been the way to go. But at that point, I'm just going to jump.
I'm with Mike on this one. I think it's a shoot and juke.
Well, it didn't work, so she got...
You know, the old shoot and juke.
Yeah.
All right. We then go to 2 weeks later and to Bernard and company. They go into the slaughterhouse of Mission Control, and Charlotte is there, so she's still alive. There's a new bit of information 2 weeks later. I think there was discussion around, you know, do they separate it? How did Bernard get separated from Charlotte? And is Charlotte still alive? Well, she is still alive. They still haven't gotten Abernathy 2 weeks later.
Which is weird considering how the episode ends. Exactly. So again, we still have some dots to connect. It's interesting that, you know, we have not really touched this 2 weeks later storyline since the very beginning, since the first episode.
True.
We didn't touch it at all.
That's true.
This is the only minute we're going to live in this. And then we just, everything else is spent in, you know, the murky time in between before Bernard ends up waking up on that beach. And as Charlotte says, you know, he seems to be slipping away from us, described both Abernathy and Bernard in that moment where, again, Bernard he's having a little bit of trouble. He has his feet out from under him, but I think he's still mentally not all there.
And is there something off-putting about, like, because we kind of mentioned it in episode one, off-putting about Charlotte's interaction with Bernard? Because when she first, she was like, oh, I didn't think you'd make it. And then in that phrase, the way she says, he seems to be slipping away from us. it did kind of feel like it worked for both Bernard and Abernathy. Is she more, and we talked about it last week, is like, how do you not see him like stumbling around the little medical room and, you know, injecting himself with the other dude's white goo? Does she know about more about Bernard than she's letting on, or is she just that kind of aloof to what is going on with Bernard?
I think that's a good question. And I know that, you know, I had a couple of tweets sent my way after our first episode, sort of correcting our stuff about what the DNA test on the door essentially was. But considering that they were in a lab, I know that they're going to escape it for now to because the next thing we see is Charlotte and Bernard. I'm assuming right after this, the scene from the first episode setting out for Abernathy. But I mean, there are probably a myriad number of ways she could probably dust for prints or something anywhere in that lab, grab something, run something, and figure out exactly what's going on.
I think it's just her personality. You see how she's not very she's not PC about anything. So, I mean, she treats Lee Sizemore like crap, and who does that?
Good Mike. People. Smart people. Logical people. No, I'll admit, we'll talk about this. You know what? I felt a pang of pity for Lee Sizemore this episode in one particular scene. We'll get to it.
We did get some backstory. Well, yes, and we will get to that.
He's hurting.
And I don't want to bury the lead too much, bury the lead in water like all the dead host bodies. We should also mention that, you know, you guys got to watch this with an actual viewing party last night as part of your annual Raleigh get-together. What was that experience like? Had you guys watched Westworld before with a room full of people?
No, that was the first time. And there was laughs, and there was like, and there was like, what? And so there was, I think the, what you would expect in a large group, maybe not as large as how you saw the premiere episode.
Slightly larger.
Yeah. The only a smidge. I think there is a sense to this season so far of people are waiting, and it's only three episodes in, but they're waiting for that moment of semblance of the main story. Like it feels like we aren't to what the main driving force of the season is, and we've gotten perspective of Dolores. We know where she seemingly wants to go, and we seemingly know where Maeve wants to go, and Bernard's kind of on his own trip. But there isn't that big reveal, like, oh man, that's what this. So I think there is a bit of, or at least I felt a sense of apprehension or reservation on the path that this season has taken so far.
Interesting. Well, I mean, we got to buckle in for the ride because also big news that came out since our last podcast, Westworld has been renewed for season 3.
Yep. Exactly.
It'd be out 2021, right? Something like that.
2025, I think, is when that season is coming on. But yeah, and I think to your other point here, Mike, this is the only bit we get from it 2 weeks later. So how do we feel about the pacing of the different storylines? Is it as relevant as we think it is, or I don't know? It seems interesting. The different stories and how they are, but it's a Nolan story, and they love just throwing timelines all over the place, seemingly without any regard to caring if you're following along.
Our happiness.
but yeah, it'll be interesting to see. That's for sure. So Bernard finds Abernathy with two hosts. That have now created a guest trafficking business with the Confederados.
Not good at math. One of them.
No. Well, they all don't seem very good at math. Yeah. What's the Cyburns guy's name again? I forget off the top of my head.
Rebus. Played by the great Stephen Ogg. He was the one who was pounding back milk every chance we saw him in the first season.
Now he's in The Walking Dead, right?
I heard he was on The Walking Dead.
He was on The Walking Dead. Because I finally figured it out last night. I go, what show is this guy in? I go, it's got to be Walking Dead.
I know him because he was the voice and inspiration behind a character in Grand Theft Auto V. You can play with three different protagonists. He plays by far the best one, which is just this absolute agent of chaos named Trevor. And so that's all I can imagine him being. But yeah, this is Rebus, who he's also the guy. But now we're starting to solve some mysteries.
Yes.
Back in the first episode when Bernard was running through the Beast, Mr. Rebus threw himself in front of hosts that were being gunned down by the stormtroopers, essentially. Now we know why, because Bernard made him a good guy.
Right.
Yep, exactly. That is an answer to that. Char and Bernie set a trap, and Bernie hardwires into Rebus's arm and turns him into the most virtuous gunslinger in the West. We then have a shootout with the Confederados. They get Abernathy, but it is spoiled by the Confederados, and Charlotte runs away the first chance she gets. In terms of watching this with a big group of people, a lot of laughs for the virtuous gunslinger turn here for Rebus.
Yeah, I loved him saying, I'm just heeding my convictions, when his convictions were extremely different about 30 seconds ago, before he went around the corner into that bush.
The magic bush.
Then we go to Dolores and her rebels. They meet with the Confederados and shows Colonel what they will be up against by giving them one of their guns. And Clementine is with their crew. I think it's the first time we've seen her.
She looked like a zombie.
Yeah, I think she's post, you know, death.
Well, remember, she got lobotomized.
Yeah, that's right.
Because Charlotte and Teresa used her as an example purposely to, like, throw the inspection to say, oh, see, look at Ford and Bernard. They're out of control. We need to fire him.
Yep. Brings in a QA person, and I think Angela tells him that if you make it over the ridge, you get to live. But he doesn't do the serpentine. I mean, how many times do we have to talk about?
It's a rookie mistake.
But you do the serpentine. The well-known rule in movies: if you're trying to run away,
in life,
going to shoot you. Serpentine
in life.
But doesn't do it, and he quickly gets shot. Will give weapons all the weapons they want, but she needs her men to kind of make it out alive. Colonel welcomes them to Fort Forlorn Hope, and Teddy doesn't seem to trust these Confederados. Teddy's still conflicted. He is very conflicted throughout this episode.
It's interesting. I like, you know, Fort Forlorn Hope is fun because it's almost oxymoronic in that, you know, forlorn inspires this idea of loneliness, solitude, sadness, but hope inspires positivity. And I also love the irony that Dolores is saying, okay, I'm going to rally my troops at, you know, Fort Forlorn Hope. Now, it turns out that's probably was not her plan the entire time. I think we're trying to figure out exactly what her plan was, or if her plan changed midstream once she sort of found out that Abernathy was there. We can sort of talk through that, but I do love the name of it. It feels like something Lee Sizemore would do, just for the fun of it.
And there was no hope for those people, three people.
Yeah, it was another bad breakup gave Lee Sizemore the idea for Camp Forlorn Hope.
Well, speaking of Sizemore, we then go to Maeve, Hector, and Lee. Lee wants to go underground. He's his usual whiny self because QA is going to be here any second. They're going to kill the hosts like you. Well,
is he whiny? But he's also right.
Yeah, but do you still trust him? He's also probably trying to play.
Well, I guess he's got an agenda, but in this case, he was right.
I wonder if Maeve believes that, you know, maybe I don't know. There's something about Maybelline in there with Maeve's belief, but I'm too tired. But basically, you know, he tried to weasel his way out of stuff the first time, and she threatened him. So maybe she assumes that, like, he knows that his only way to be safe and not be like that poor technician with several bullet holes in his back is to do what she says.
Yeah, right. That's true. They run into the Ghost Nation. They want Lee, but Maeve needs him, so Hector kind of stalls so that they can run away. Maeve's mind control doesn't work on the Ghost Nation. Is that because the network is now down? Possibly she needs, like, whatever Wi-Fi to be able to connect mentally.
Good point, Jay. I never thought about that.
Between them.
Well, it's a good question, because I feel like the Ghost Nation was one of the lingering mysteries from season one that we still don't really know about.
It's true, we still don't.
Because remember, like, they kidnap Stubbs, and Stubbs is going to show up a couple weeks later completely fine. So, and we see that they sort of take Grace at the end. I feel like Ghost Nation, they might have been under the control of Ford, but I kind of feel like they were purposely like rogue and out on their own. Maybe there's someone else who's able to control them, but I would say that even though Maeve thinks she controls all hosts, maybe the Ghost Nation are just such a different type that even she is not able to control
them.
Well,
here's the question. If Stubbs is alive, is the Ghost Nation some like security protocol system that if the hosts turn, they are the ones that actually collect the hosts and take them to safety?
Interesting. So they're sort of like the men on the inside.
Yeah, they're, and again, if we're talking about white blood cells, you know, getting rid of the viruses, they're painted in white. So maybe they're the protectors, like a part of the QA system. Because to me, it's like, yeah, they took Stubbs, and Stubbs is somehow alive. We spent all this time introducing us to Grace, so we assume she is going to live, even though it's kind of set up that she made it through whatever arduous survival with the tiger, and they're there with a knife wanting to... We assume to scalp her, but I would think that would be kind of an unfortunate end for that character that we've been introduced to. So I would assume she's still alive. And then they wanted Lee, and they're, you know, very determined to get Lee. He is not a host; he is you know, quote unquote, a guest or an executive. And so maybe that's part of their protocol. That's my theory.
That's good.
That's really interesting. I like that. And let's also remember that in season one, they were the ones that knew about, you know, the staff in the hazmat suits. They were the ones that Hector told Maeve about, like, oh, they are the ones that see these shadow walkers, these creatures that come from other worlds. So I'm liking this idea that they are sort of the conduit between the staff in HQ and the hosts out in the Wild West of the park.
Yep.
You should podcast with Lack of Sleep more often, Jay. You're really on the ball today. Just
Jack, I'm gonna have that framed.
I'll sign it. I'll notarize. I have it notarized.
They run away and
yes, you really need a picture notarized. That's exactly what the purpose is.
Well, it's like the fart gate. I mean, it's just
exactly. I will screen cap the audio file.
And then, I could come back and deny
and
it.
And then get it tattooed. Or actually, yeah, we're just partnering. Say, yeah,
but considering that we're now in a world where you can tattoo audio files, I'm sure it will not be too bad for you to put a sound wave on a piece of paper. It's not that out of the realm of possibility.
All right, I'm going
to
say right now, that was not my voice. I did not say that.
They run away and find an elevator that is just up, ready for them to get into. I thought that was a little interesting.
And here's the thing. I don't remember the landscape. Is there a chance this could be Charlotte's elevator?
But that one went down.
But it also went back out. Up if they were going to, because they were walking true. Out. And, so I don't
thought,
know. I don't
thought,
know
my
how
first
the,
thought was it was.
But okay, if it was Charlotte's elevator, then they would have just walked right into her little secret DNA collection room.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if Charlotte's really, you know, taking that much caution, considering that her life is on the line
true.
At this point, that she needs to find Abernathy. I mean, it might be a little too cute to have them stumble upon it, and I don't know if Lee knows about it. I know Lee was sort of working closely with Charlotte at the end, but I don't think even he knows about the lab. It would be interesting to have the three of them stumble upon it, but yeah, maybe there's just a series of elevators in this park that we don't know. Maybe there are more labs, almost a map of labs that you can make with various symbols attributed to it. Some black light, massacre of a painting that will cause hours upon weeks upon years of speculation.
Man. Is there a ball gag and get trapped in it?
Oh, no, yeah, well, that already happened with Armistice, right? She had her arm trapped in the wall, and that's when it showed up on the door. We just didn't see it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's true. That's very true.
Maybe that's what's in Grace's notebook.
Well, exactly. That's her hatch door map. So then we go back to Camp Forlorn Hope, or Fort Forlorn Hope. Say that five times fast. Abernathy and Bernard are brought into the camp. Dolores is reunited with her daddy, and she has Teddy take him to the infirmary, and she tosses Bernard into jail with the rest of them. Teddy doesn't remember that he played her father. She considers Abernathy her home, but is sad that they've done something to him. Says Teddy is all that she has. Abernathy remembers his daddy role for a moment, and Dolores shares happy memories she has had with him, tells him that he told her to run away, and she confides that she pulled the trigger and started a war, but the others don't see it yet. And then he says it's getting late. It's time that we go home. But then he goes back into, you know, need to get to the train and kind of glitching out. But what are the thoughts here? Like, for me, with Dolores, this scene so far, I go between, her being naive to having some master plan we just haven't been revealed to yet. But it could be, and it's being acted incredibly well by Evan Rachel Wood.
Like, yeah, she's amazing.
Like, fantastic, because she's portraying somebody at almost coming into creation for the first time, like a very like newborn-esque viewpoint of the world, which kind of has that naiveness to it. But then she's just so brutally violent. And seemingly having some plan in her head for how she is going to dominate this world. And this scene, to me, like, really showed the two halves of that. All right, what did you guys feel?
I was waiting for when she said, "Teddy, you're all I have. It's a shame I'm going to have to kill you." I was waiting for that line.
It's interesting that she says, "You're all I have," when her goal right now is to amass a giant army. But, yeah, I mean, this was... I was happy to see this part of Evan Rachel Wood. I like the progression that the Dolores character has taken, but part of me does kind of miss that season one Dolores as well. And I feel like we get a lot of complexity here, but it's interesting to sort of see, you know, she gets lulled into this fantasy. You know, when Abernathy talks about like going back to the ranch, he is also, again, he's pulling out his Professor Waits. He's quoting King Lear again when he says, "I am bound upon a wheel of fire that mine own tears do scald like molten lead," essentially saying that, like, he's being tortured. I don't know if that means literally by the information that he has or what have you. But Dolores also had a really interesting quote here where she says, you know, she tells this story about, like, moving wayward cattle back to the ranch. And I wonder if that's sort of the attitude that she's taking now, which is, like, I need to... I mean, she's before in Fort... Forlorn Hope, she says that, like, she compares the Confederados to children. I wonder if she feels like, okay, I need to be the one to move these people into where they're supposed to go, because I'm the only one that knows where their proper places are.
Yep.
Yeah.
And there is a frustration there. And, you know, and I think there is that the moment of her telling Teddy that he's all that she has, because there, with, you know, Teddy's quote-unquote betrayal later on, maybe that kind of puts her over the edge to even, you know, think Teddy, or confirm to her that Teddy isn't, you know, on the same level as
Dolores. It's not who she needs to have as a right hand man, mm-hmm. right hand person. I'm sorry.
Well, he's a man. So
I'm just saying. Playing it safe.
We then go to Maeve, Hector, and Lee. They're walking on the ground. Hector brings up, "There must be a history between her and the Ghost Nation. Otherwise, why is she so scared?" Maeve assures him that they will leave the park and be together. This upsets Lee, who programmed Hector to love no one but Isabella. They're supposed to be alone, not to have effed. Lee wrote Hector's, and we find out, Maeve astutely finds out, Hector's backstory is a mirror to his own lost love. And Maeve thinks it's sad. So, yes, we got a bit more context to Lee here. He's still kind of a sad individual, but we kind of maybe
understand find out
more about
more.
His sadness. Mike, what do you feel? Any feelings here?
Yeah, I mean, one of the major gripes I had with Lee to begin with was that he just didn't have a lot of, I don't know, shadiness to him, in a manner of speaking, that, like, he was pretty two-dimensional. He almost seemed like a host. He had a narrative built for him of, like, here's the... kind of like, you know, rakish writer. So I do appreciate that they're giving him at least a little bit more, and you sort of see a reason why he does the way he does and why he definitely puts up a front. And I also like this interesting idea that, like, Hector is almost, I don't know, like, his character, where it's, and it's also a pretty funny image as well, that, like, of course, if Lee's going to write a character based on himself, it's going to be like this ruggedly handsome, badass man who gets whoever what he wants. Yep. But it also then causes some really interesting dynamics, too, with, you know, now you can understand why he was so resilient in the beginning of this scene of, like, no, you two and I are supposed to get together, exactly. Is because he's saying, like, hey, I have personal stakes in this character, and you're not doing the things that I want you to do. You're not fulfilling the reason why I want you in there. So, you know, it was some, you know, Lee Sizemore has a little bit of a sob story now, but, you know, if if we have to deal with him for a while, I guess let's make him more complicated. So I guess it's sort of like a win-win in that scenario.
Well, and I think one of your criticisms maybe last season about Lee is if he's like the mirror for the writers on the show or just writers in general, they weren't giving him a lot. And I thought it was just interesting. It is that kind of that writer's perspective of being upset if the work that they created is being, you know, bastardized in some way, or somebody's taking their creation and doing something else that wasn't their intent with it. It was that for Lee, but at such a personal level to who he is. I thought there's just a very interesting, like a really well kind of laid out scene. That adds interesting layers.
I like the scene when Hector has him up against the wall and he says, "You don't know who I am. You don't know anything about me." And he starts repeating something. And then Lee Sizemore finishes it.
Yeah, because he wrote those lines.
He's like going, "All right, maybe you know me a little." but I like that. It was a night, because even Maeve had to look like, okay. Yeah, that was a nice scene. Nice scene for Lee.
You're not just a little Amish boy we're having tag along here.
Exactly.
But I think it then asks the question, what use does she have for him now? Especially, you know, later when we get to Felix.
Well, she needs to find her. She wants to find her daughter.
That's true. I guess he knows that. I don't know if there's another more grander reason. But anyway.
Maybe she falls in love with him.
She fell in love with Hector. I don't think she really loves Hector. I think she's using Hector, but
I don't know. I think she has legitimate. I feel like we don't want to conflate Maeve and Dolores too much. I do feel like Maeve has this sort of like carnal lust towards Hector that maybe, I don't know if it's exactly like gushy love, but I feel like there's at least a connection there. And he's also sort of her rock. What Dolores is alluding to Teddy is, she says that he is, but I don't really know if he is. I feel like Hector really is someone that Maeve leans upon to help get her through these tough times.
I would agree.
But if that's the case, and she realizes that Hector is an avatar for Lee's emotional baggage, is there now a stronger connection between her and Lee with that intel?
I think there was. I think she did look at him with a little more respect or understanding than she'd had before. I think that's the reason for the scene.
I
was just going to say that I think we also remember that Maeve towards the end of this season one had this staunch anti-human philosophy, right? Because she woke up in the middle of HQ. She's feeling like these people are toying with her and playing with her and literally making them one of their playthings, that she has it out for them. So it's interesting for her to get to know people like Felix and, you know, and Lee, and like almost gain sympathy for them. You know, I feel like maybe if Dolores was in Maeve's shoes at the end of season one, she would have killed Felix. She wouldn't have just like sent him down the elevator. She would have pushed him down the elevator.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to see. Like, so I think, you know, if we're dealing with this possible Maeve versus Dolores showdown, Maeve is showing the one to be the more sympathetic person, which again is ironic considering how much of a badass she was in that first season compared to Dolores. It's almost like a flip-flop there.
Yep, exactly. And speaking of Dolores, we have a Dolores and Bernard reunion. Dolores wonders if Bernard has any of Arnold really in him. Bernard quips that he is a host with functions programmed into him. Dolores thinks she has gone from I will to I may. Asks Bernard to fix Abernathy. Bernard asks what she wants. Dolores wants to dominate this world. And Bernard, more pessimistically, thinks the world is a speck of dust on a much larger universe. You can't dominate it. She chides him for never being outside of the park and makes their case for survival. This is the quote started this recap with. There is beauty in who we are. Shouldn't we, too, try to survive? Thoughts here for this scene between the two of them?
Well, I was waiting. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I thought it was a good scene, but she said he's never been outside the park.
Bernard right? hasn't.
Yeah. Bernard wasn't outside the park in the beginning?
No, that's just like implanted memories.
Okay.
Well, but now I need to. Sorry, now I'm thinking. Does she know that he is a host?
Yes, she does, I think. Because she knows that she knows that she says, like, do you even have any Arnold in you? She knows
Because
she has the memories of Arnold. She has, because we had that in episode two or last week's episode where she remembers being outside of the park with, you know, Arnold, the real Arnold. And I think that's in her kind of criticism of Bernard that he's never even been out or off of the park. Because, I mean, seemingly if Bernard was out of the park, well, I guess if Arnold has somehow been scrubbed that much from it, there wouldn't be the, like, hey, Arnold. But, but yeah, so I think she definitely knows that Bernard is an avatar to look just like Arnold, but is not the person that has kind of set Dolores off on her journey and seemingly the rest of the hosts on the island.
Would she keep Bernard around if he couldn't try and help fix her, you know, because he was trying to help fix her dad? Would she just shot him, or?
No, I think she has, even when she first saw him and said put him in the jail, there's like this inquisitiveness to Bernard that I thought was interesting. And it's just how I saw it. She has more that she needs from Bernard, or more to come between those two and that connection.
Okay. Yeah, let's also remember that, you know, he didn't realize he was a host, but I mean, they had forged a connection. He kept, you know, they kept having these diagnostic tests together. So maybe she feels a tinge of a connection with him. And also, because he's a staff member, if she wants to do some more stuff in HQ and possibly leverage his position to eventually reach the outer limits and get out of there, that'll be a nice thing to utilize as well.
Or if she does miss Arnold and she wishes to get him back, I mean, it might be a similar thing to why Ford created him in the first place. It might be a similar type thing.
When he says the world is a speck of dust, you can't dominate it, but she doesn't believe him, right? She just...
Well, they definitely have two... It's interesting how much Bernard, you know, he is aware of who he is, that he is not human. He is a creation of somebody that lived in the past.
Right.
And so, you know, him becoming aware and Dolores becoming aware, and they're on completely different kind of paths where... he has a much more seemingly pessimistic view of what his role is in all of this now or hasn't found what his role in all of this is. Seemingly even 2 weeks later, he's still kind of in amnesia on what he's supposed to do. But Dolores is very much knowing what she wants to do and where she wants to go.
Oh, yeah, definitely that.
So that's what I thought.
Yeah, I mean, it comes down to, like you said before, it's the you will versus I may. It's Bernard looking at it as these are the limitations that we have against our goals, whereas Dolores says, hell no, I'm breaking through all these boundaries. I'm blasting through these walls with the gunpowder I have lined up outside the barracks. I'm ready to you know, plow through the world.
Yep. Yep. And I wonder if there is a moment for Bernard where he does also flip from I will to I may. And this scene seemed to kind of show they're on different ends of the spectrum, and maybe it'll flip, or maybe he'll get to Dolores's level. We then go to Maeve, Hector, and Lee. They reunite with Armistice with a dragon. I thought that was a funny quip from Hector there. And Felix and Sylvester, who's been quieted with a grenade under his chin.
That was nice.
Armistice has gotten a nice replacement for her lost forearm and hand.
Yeah.
And Sly has a wrapped package. Do we know what's in the wrapped package? Was that from last season?
No, I mean, I think the last time we saw Sylvester was Maeve, you know, showed how advanced she had become by slashing Sylvester's throat. And after she made Felix fix him up, he realized, like, oh, damn, I'm going to step away from this. This is maybe too hairy of a situation. And that's why Felix was the one to primarily, you know, accompany May on her big move to get out of the park. So it's interesting to see how he got his way back. I'll be happy to have him just because he's a fun source of comic relief. He'll be the one to, like, complain on this journey, especially as things get colder and they get into Shogun World. But yeah, I don't know how he made his way back there. And yeah, the armistice thing, I totally was, I guess I got bought along with what the writers wanted us to do of like, wait a minute, I remember she lost her arm in the post-credit scene in season one. What's going on? But now she has this really, I mean, I wouldn't call it a robot hand because technically all of them have robot hands, but this is like more of like a, Terminator. I don't know, like a prosthetic almost.
Yeah, prosthetic. Yeah, or yeah, the Anakin Skywalker prosthetic.
I am your father. What?
You are his father.
Any guess on what's in? I think Jay mentioned earlier. What is it? What is the package?
Yeah, he has a wrapped something. What is? What does he have? Like, there's no mention. They don't talk about it.
No, he's just carrying it and complaining how cold it is.
So was this rendezvous, was this part of May's plan, or is it, were they on their own path on doing something, or Armistice had her own agenda that she was trying to fulfill, or was there a uniting an intention between the
two? I don't think it was coincidence. I think it was probably intended. So it must be a different part. So that elevator must have been a different part, right?
Okay, clearly, yeah, I mean, I think.
Well, I'm trying to remember where, you know, we left Armistice, who again, like, it seemed like she had cut her arm off. I don't know if she went to go find Hector or if she like stumbled upon these guys. I don't think this was part of May's plan all along, because again, it does seem like she called an audible. Everyone was pretty surprised to see her come back. So yeah, I don't know exactly how these three got together, but I'm glad because now we get this sort of super group back, because you know, Hector, Armistice, Maeve, and Felix were the quartet that took on essentially all of Delos HQ in the finale, and now they have a couple more people to boot. So I would say that, I mean, I could probably understand that maybe some of the other concerns that people have with this season so far was that they felt that people were too disparate, you know, not really interacting with each other, doing a bunch of different things before presumably coming back together near the end of the season. But now we're starting to get different conglomerations back together, which it makes things more exciting. It makes it feel closer to the Westworld that we know and love.
Exactly. And speaking of that, we go to Dolores and Bernard. Bernard is trying to crack into what is wrong with Abernathy. His thin personalities are there to cover up some kind of encryption key. He says that whatever is in him, as long as they have him, QA will be following them. Dolores doesn't seem to mind that aspect. I mean,
and I believe Abernathy quotes a Gertrude Stein poem called A Substance and a Cushion, if my research is to be trusted. he says, what is the use of a violent kind of delightfulness if there is, and I think it gets cut up there, but the full line is, what is the use of a violent kind of delightfulness if there's no pleasure in not getting tired of it?
Any greater thoughts be to that line, or is it just like a line that kind of fits in with the violence delights have violent ends, Abernathy quote?
What? Yeah, well, I think maybe, because I think, you know, having violent and delights are obviously the words that stick out, but this one almost like mixes the two of them together.
Yeah.
It's a violent kind of delightfulness, and it's saying that, you know, what's the use of being so masochistic, or by being so sadistic, if you're not going to have fun doing it? And that is kind of Dolores's MO here, where, you know, again, I can't say this enough, that I think going into this episode, at least I was thinking she was all about the robot revolution movement, but it turns out she is much more selective than I think we bargained her to be. And I think that sort of ties into how much she loves, you know, killing the general and then bringing him back to life to, you know, make him stump for her. I think it's these things that she really enjoys. She loves the violent delights and the delightful violence.
Jack, any thoughts there?
No, I'm listening.
Okay.
I think with Dolores, I think it's basically if you're either in her, which you mentioned was first episode or second, you're either with my dreams, or you're not. So if she feels that people aren't going to work with her, she kills them off.
Well,
that's the thing though, is that the Confederados didn't seem like they weren't going to work with her. They seemed like they were falling under her line.
They questioned her strategy, right? They questioned her strategy. They kind of argued with her a little bit. You know, it's my way or the highway with her. Either you're with her 100% or you're not.
Well, it seems like there's something greater to that though, because it does feel.
You don't question her. You don't question her.
But to what she did didn't seem like her responding, like they failed in their quest to be a part of her team. I feel like from the beginning, she had no intention of having them be a part of her team.
No, she was definitely using them.
Well, exactly. And that's where I think, to Mike's point, if we thought Dolores was leading some grand revolution, that doesn't seem to be a case. She has a far more selfish drive to this, and we just don't know what that is yet. That's still
that's why we said last week, is she a good guy or a bad guy? And right now I don't see her as the good guy or good person, I should say.
I mean, it's tough to say who really is the good guy at this point, though, because then I guess what the other option would be Maeve, but Maeve working completely selfishly as well. She's not saying, hey, let's help everybody. She's saying, no, I'm only here because I want my daughter back. Like, I don't care what you're doing. I'm going to walk by you to take care of what I need to do.
But is that being, I mean, it's, you would do anything for your kids. So is that being, it's, I guess, selfish, but in a way that's just the way life is. I mean, you're going to do whatever it takes to protect your child.
And I'm speaking more towards who is, I guess, if we're going with good and bad, of this idea of helping the, you know, the host break free of their shackles of servitude.
No, nobody's doing doing that. No.
Yes, that's the point that I'm getting at, is that it doesn't seem like Dolores might have seemed like the person that was pushing that, but it turns out that she has a much different agenda, unfortunately, because these hosts are now, I think, you know, we'll see how many of these hosts wearing the pieces of black cloths over their face are going to be the ones ending up in that lake at the end of the day.
Right.
We then go to Charlotte and the merry band of QA. So we see her arrive to the QA team, who are about to target Fort Forlorn Hope first. And Char asks for her own special force team. We then go to Fort Forlorn Hope. And Dolores' rebels and confederados are ready to fight QA. There's Nitro underground near the front gate, and Bernard breaks through to the one-time use keys and says, "Oh my god!" Now that there's a lot there on the screen, Mike, was there anything of relevance beyond it saying this was the one-time use key being unlocked?
As I said before, I didn't really take a look at it. The only other thing I noticed, as I mentioned before, were the dual hexagons in the bottom corner, which again is the insignia that Grace drew in her notebook. I don't know if it's like that thing you used to do in like middle school where you make the S using the vertical S. lines. Yeah, where it was like, where it's just something you do when you were bored. But I think that's sort of the connection point that we're assuming, that that Grace and Charlotte, and maybe we'll meet some other characters, might be involved. Maybe there's a whole conspiracy going on with some of these humans that we don't even know, where they're all working together to mine this data out of the park for the benefit of the Delos Corporation.
Yep. QA approaches the fort. They quickly advance. Char's group goes into the back and gets Abernathy. Bernard hides. His bad trembling is getting even worse. Dolores and Teddy go after Char's team. She gets hit a few times, but they get away. Dolores wants to go to Sweetwater, and she needs something there. Do we know what she needs there? Any theories here?
I'm trying to think about if there was anything special in Sweetwater. I mean, maybe she's like Bill in that she knows where like secret stocks of something are hidden. I'm trying to remember if there was like special access to anything in Sweetwater. It seemed like a central hub, but I don't know if she's talking about like the can that she always used to lose. but it's interesting because
maybe it's not corn in there. Maybe there's something else in there.
Yeah, another grenade. But we haven't been back to Sweetwater yet. We've been to, you know, the new Pariah. We've been to all these other places, but we actually haven't gone back to Sweetwater, which is really the central hub that existed throughout season one. So it'll be interesting to see how massacred that place was after, you know, hell really broke loose. But yeah, I mean, Dolores is also, it's interesting how, I mean, do we feel like her, I'll go back to the question I asked before, with all of this, do we feel like her plan has changed, where now it seems like she is pursuing Abernathy, despite knowing that this is all a narrative, much like Maeve, she feels like in her gut that there is a familial connection that she needs to pursue. She almost becomes, her and Charlotte almost become more alike in that regard, where they're both like thirsting after this man. And then in a manner of speaking, that sort of goes back to the Abernathy and Bernard comparisons too, where both of them are also a little bit worse for wear, where Abernathy has these, both of them contain vital information, but neither one of them are able to get it across because they keep having problems.
Yeah, exactly. And it's interesting. Bernard is also having those. It is interesting. Well, because Bernard got shot in the head last season, right?
And Ford made him shoot himself in the head, but not so much to make him kill him, just to graze it, injure him enough so it knocks him out, and then they could wake him up again.
True. Okay. I didn't know if there was maybe there's some it injured his brain cortex or something when that happened. And that's maybe some of why he's a little messed up. But it could be a greater thing than that. I'm glad you brought that up, because I was going to bring up as well, because it seems the Abernathy being there has changed her approach to, you know, whatever her game is or whatever her end game is. Because the plan does seem to shift, because Teddy's kind of trying to keep up. He's like, wait, what's going on? Because he's not down for, you know, betraying these people, because, you know, he's just been pitched on. All of us have been kind of led astray, and we've been used, and we need to kind of fight back against the humans.
And he's also wondering where she's going too.
Well, yeah, and so he's like,
she left the front line to go after her dad.
So he's barely catching up to that, you know, sales pitch that Dolores has given. And now she's seemingly pivoting to Abernathy, and now she has to go back to Sweetwater, because maybe this whole talk conversation with Abernathy, or what she's trying to find from Abernathy, has now connected her to Sweetwater somehow. And she's killing the Confederados, who are not humans, but they are hosts. The dynamic for Teddy, one, not being able to keep up, but also kind of questioning her kind of pivot, I think is interesting for Dolores. Her plans have shifted. It's two things. Either her plans have shifted, or this is her grand plan all along. If the title of the episode has Machiavellian roots, you know, maybe there is a greater Machiavellian plan that she is putting out, and she's not really looping anybody into that. And to use a Keith quote from Survivor, you know, poor Teddy is all like Keith. Like, I don't know what it's all about. I just got to stick to the plan.
Go ahead.
In any battle, if it's something's working, you have to stick with it. And like, she just pulled an audible right in the middle of the battle.
Or it's either seemingly inaudible or it's not. It was part of the plan all along.
Yeah, did she know they were going to take Abernathy? No, she didn't know. Unless she set them up to take Abernathy.
I don't think so, because I think Abernathy really changed the game. But the thing that I'm fixated on is not even the Abernathy part of it. It's this idea that, you know, she got the Major to agree, and she got the Confederados all set up on the ground to take on this horde, and she really, like, painted them a verbal picture of, like, these are these monstrous creatures that are coming in. And then it turns out that she not only purposely barricades the door, but has her men stand on the other side to pick off all the people that were not gunned down yet by the staff. What do you think the purpose of that was? Do you think that was something that she sort of changed plans with overnight? Because I would assume that she came into, you know, Fort Forlorn Hope with the idea of building an army, because she had heard that, oh, these 600 to 800 people are going to come in with wanting your head on a stake. But she almost then shot herself in the foot, and she's going to get shot several more times trying to find Abernathy, and essentially, like, leaving these guys up as bait. Though I guess now that I'm talking it through, did she want to use them as, you know, distractions that when drew them close enough that when she blew up that gunpowder, that took out a significant amount of staff members?
Yeah, she used them as basically human shields and then let them into a trap.
But forcibly killed them.
Yeah. Well, even after they were shot and everything was,
yeah. And then
they opened up
them.
A gate and they went and stabbed them. So her intention was to kill them all along.
Yeah,
I would think, or like I don't, I would think so.
Dolores betrays the Confederados, leaving them out in front to die. Teddy asks her what the hell she's doing. She has her troops shoot the Confederados at the gate, and she has Angela blow up the nitro, seemingly taking out the QA. Bernard can barely walk as he tries to get away, but Clementine knocks him out and drags him. Dolores tells Teddy to take out Major Craddock and what's left of his men. The Major tells him they're both triggermen to tyrants, but you don't believe the orders you've been given. What I see is pathetic. Teddy tells him he ain't nothing alike. He's just a child. He doesn't shoot him and tells him to get out. Dolores sees his betrayal. So is this why Teddy is, which we haven't really, have we gotten that confirmed that he's the one floating in the water? I know that's,
I know it's a theory out there, but I haven't seen the,
but is that how he ends up in the water?
I mean, I think it's definitely a start. I think that it's him. I could expect now we're sort of going to see this beginning of an undermining of Dolores from Teddy, where he's not necessarily taking her marching orders from now on. And I also wonder if the release of Craddock is going to have any sort of effect too, where maybe Craddock's going to be able to run to the next outpost, gather some Confederados, and then descend on Dolores when she least expects it. And maybe Teddy dies in that massacre as well. Dolores like leaves him to die.
Yeah,
almost. Leaves him high and dry before he gets soaked in water.
She proved today she could do it. So, but is it Teddy's fault because he doesn't know what, like Jay was saying, he doesn't know what's going on. You know, he just found out what the last episode, what you know, his past and what's going on, and he's really not had time to soak everything in, and she's just kind of changing the plans on him.
Well, and she's showing frustration that everybody else isn't seeing what she's seeing, or
right.
And you know, I feel bad for Teddy. But he's playing to his character. He's playing to his moral center.
Right.
And I think that's sort of what I'm having a lot of fun with Dolores' storyline is, because I think coming to season two, I was expecting her to be total OP. You know, especially when we saw like the image of her riding on this horse, picking people up. I thought this was the Dolores that we're going to get. But I think what we're being surprised by as viewers are the fact that she's kind of struggling because she is all the way at the fourth hurdle in the race. And these people have barely crossed the starting line.
Yeah.
In terms of like coming into their own. They have their own things that they're dealing with. You know, you have these people hanging Lawrence, like they don't even know what's going on in another sector of the park. So I'm glad because this actually, you know, gives Dolores some obstacles. Like, yes, you are now this sentient being, but at the same time, nobody else is. So good luck trying to get them in your corner.
But wouldn't she be better if she's trying to, if she wants to defeat, unless this weapon she's going after is the weapon to end all weapons. And she can control. Would you need? Don't you need an army? And she could be. She's strong enough, and she's BA enough to lead an army. Would it be better to, instead of killing the potential army?
Well, it seems like she, to her mind and to her plan, she doesn't.
It's like what she's. I think what she said, that not all can go to the survivor.
We don't all deserve to make it. Is I believe
right,
what she said.
Is what she said. So. I guess, but you know,
it's just going to be her riding an earth mover, just.
Well, remember that, like, throughout this episode, she regards them as children, and so I really feel like she feels like a babysitter or like a mother hen, essentially saying like these people are all beneath me, and maybe that's another reason why she's totally fine giving up so many of these host lives just to get what she wants. I mean, maybe this is an example of she'll bring on a group of people and then use them as bait to kill off more QA people. Maybe this is just a taste of what Dolores's Machiavellian like tendencies are.
All right,
you're all right, Jack. Is going to be okay.
Well, I'm just saying she could have been a great leader. Now she's just
you threw it all away.
Yeah.
Well, let's
she's no longer getting my vote. That's all I'm saying.
Let's check in.
I do not think there was really a popular election held.
We could have had something, Dolores. I could have followed you into the ends of the world. Now I can't. Wait.
Don't tell her I said that.
let's resume with the dead tiger and the lady, Grace. She gets on shore. Same shore where we saw the dead tiger in episode one, only to be found by the Ghost Nation. I've already said my theory on the Ghost Nation, and I'm sticking to it. We then quickly go to Maeve and crew. Lee has taken them through the Klondike. Sylvester has there's a funny quip between Sylvester and Maeve saying, not that I like to complain, but it's freaking cool. She's like, you love to complain.
that was a great line.
The homesteads are close. They find a camp, and Lee digs into a mound of ice or snow and finds a decapitated shogun. The others get to the camp when Lee runs in, saying they have to get out of here right now. They're approached by a running swordsman, samurai, or someone. And then it closes out the episode.
This is fun because, well, also I love the Eastern influenced music that's over the credits. But I love this idea because I think we were assuming that, oh, we're going to Shogun World, you know, in season two. But I think what this great initial cold open showed when both Grace and the Tiger were able to cross the lasers into other parks are that now we can see the possibility of people bleeding into other parks or all feeding into this central Westworld hub. So, I mean, at least I didn't even fathom the possibility of, oh, there's a samurai warrior now in Westworld. But it looks like that might be the case. So it's almost like they're in familiar territory for us, but they're completely unfamiliar figures, which I think is a perfect way to introduce it without completely immersing us in an entirely new world.
Yep. Go ahead, Jack.
Was the guy? Is the guy with the? Is he a host or is that's? I guess we don't know yet. A host or is it one of the visitors?
I would assume it. Well, I guess you don't know if.
It could be like the veil of Shogun World, where he's like he's so into being a samurai.
Yeah. I mean, that would be interesting if there was like an analogous character in each, you know, Bill playing that, you know, gunslinger role.
Because if you have the money and if that's your dream and that you have the money, you keep going back to the same park, you know, like what Bill was there for 30 years, right? Of course, he helped develop it. There could be like, you know, an expert at each, you know, because they've been there so long.
From a storyline perspective, that'd be kind of weird if like there was one in each park. And then what is the eventual thing there for Bill's storyline is like they all get together and then.
Yeah, the meeting of the Bills. Yeah.
And there could be seven of them, right?
Seven samurais. Oh, my God.
I was going to say, I was thinking Magnificent Seven, but
that's what Magnificent Seven is based off of.
I mean, one inspires the other, basically.
Yeah.
And then you have the music. Dun, 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 dun. Anyway, okay, go ahead.
I think it's definitely a host, but you never know. It's a good point or call out there, Jack.
Yeah, because now we get to figure out, I mean, if it is a host, like, what is their narrative? Have they gone rogue as well? We're assuming so, considering that the guide and the tiger went rogue back in Raj Land. And if so, what does that mean? What other people from Shogun Land are going to be coming over? You know, what are they doing here? How is Maeve's daughter involved? Did she wander off the plantation into Shogun Land? I like the door this opens, and not the door, but a door has been opened now. And I'm excited that we now get to sort of finally peek in there. We've had a couple of episodes of staying at home where we know, but now we're finally able to step outside into this cold, bitter world and see what it has to offer.
If it's not a host, I'll remind you guys next week that I said it could possibly not be a host. If it is a host, then I'll just drop it.
Love that selective memory. Very, very Westworld-esque to have these memories that we don't remember until certain points in time.
I don't remember saying that.
Jack, all you say is like, that means nothing to me.
Doesn't sound like anything to me.
Doesn't sound like anything to me, yeah.
Nope. That was Mike's Skype.
Don't throw shade on the machines. That's what this entire show is about.
Oh, man. All right. Well, that is what we thought about this episode. Let's get into what you all thought about this episode with some listener feedback. Here we go.
Listener feedback.
All right. It's listener feedback time. We got some emails to jump into here. This first one's from Jonathan. It's actually in related to last week's episode. Feedback to us specifically. Hey guys, love the podcast. I just want to mention a couple of things. You said in the review that we don't know if Juliet ever visited the park, but going by Logan's comment to William when they first enter Westworld in season one, episode two, he says, it's not like my sister didn't ride a few cowboys when she was here. So we know she visited the park at least once. Maybe it was the bachelorette party. The second thing is, Ford definitely knew about the collection of guest data, as his lunch conversation with Teresa in episode one, season four, hinted at. He said, we know everything about our guests, just like we know everything about our employees. added to the fact that they were sitting at the exact same table she sat at when she was 7 years old, visiting the park with her parents. Ah, good call out there. Can't wait for the next episode of both the show and the podcast, Jonathan in the UK. Great stuff.
Great job, Jonathan.
Yeah, great catch, Jonathan. Going all the way back to episode two. But yeah, I think it's a good call. And Juliet's also sort of a big mystery as well. Now that we know her and Emily, I don't know if we're going to go that far, if we're going to go really back to the William and Logan stuff again, since I think we sort of talked about last week how that might be a good series wrap on Logan. But there might be like a grown-up Emily wandering around there. There might be an older Juliet wandering around there. So that's definitely something to keep our eyes out for. Oh, wait, no, sorry, Juliet's dead.
Or is she?
What am I saying?
Or is she?
Or is she?
Or maybe we'll see. Yeah, we'll see. This next email starts out, "Hello from Ethan to my favorite threesome, Jay, Jack, and Mike." Although you do have competition from the Maeve, Lee, and Paulo threesome combo. They are pretty great.
Poor Rodrigo Santoro. He can never, like, he had a role in Love Actually where he's, like, fawned upon as the perfect human being, but now all we remember him for is poor Paulo.
Well, in this kind of TV show fan community, unfortunately, the Nikki and Paulo is a hard thing to shake. Is they actually play Nikki? Has she done anything else since then?
She was in that show with what's his name? I drew a blank on his name, so it's not going to work. Billy Dee Williams. But it took too long, so go ahead.
Okay. They're pretty great. Do you think this season will end with Apollo Hector being buried alive? Anyway, I'm mostly able to just ignorantly enjoy this narrative as it plays out, but every once in a while I stop and think, hang on a second, how exactly is it that this character is self-aware but that one isn't? Has the show given us a definitive guide onto how each person has awakened and which people haven't? Think of the stable boy from episode 201 who was just running his program. Is it like a virus slowly affecting all of the hosts? Is it just the ones Robert picked? Or does Dolores somehow have magic powers to enact this awakening? Is she playing Desmond to our Flash sideways? Does she need to drown people like Charlie to get them to realize what's happening? Or does everyone just need to find their constant? Some clarification on which hosts are self-aware, which aren't, and why would be great. Speaking of clarification, I hear you, Ethan, wondering what's up with the other Ethan. Finding one's constant reveals truth, and finding my constant reveals that I'm not actually Ethan, but instead I am not Ethan. Until next week, love forever, my friends, not Ethan.
Oh my God, we're going through like a Bernard situation here, where it's like, I'm not Ethan? Wait, I am Ethan. I've been implanted with Ethan's memories.
Well, as far as the hosts, they all have different intelligent levels, right?
Yes, but I think his point is like, why are some on their path? Why are some killing everybody? And why are some seemingly more enlightened, like Dolores? Or is Dolores and Maeve really the only enlightened individuals? It is an interesting question because it does
seem
different.
They only seem to be the two with a plan.
Yeah.
Or an agenda, where the other ones are just, they're just kind of going along with what they've been doing the whole time, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question as well with like Hector, for example, when like, you know, did he have his own sort of awakening moment when he found the bullet inside of Maeve from the last time she died? We didn't really get that side of him. I feel like we're getting a lot around, you know, Maeve and Bernard and Dolores when it seems like these other hosts are sort of coming into their own awakening. But maybe it is just a thing of a setting that they're being given that has not been tampered with.
But Hector doesn't even know what's, because he's going back to that scene with Lee Sizemore. You don't know anything about me. And he didn't really catch on that Lee programmed him. Even though Lee was telling him, yeah, I programmed you. You're supposed to be doing this. You're supposed to be doing that. So I don't know. I just think that maybe it's a different level of host, robot, or whatever it is. And maybe it takes time. That could be wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, it'd be interesting to see if there is more revealed there. To me, it makes sense if it's like a virus, but without any network to really connect them, seemingly, if he has to hardwire into these hosts to make adjustments to them, how would the virus work? Or is it just that phrase, these violent delights have violent ends, is a way for that whatever code trigger. Maybe is in the background of the brain.
It's like a secret awaken. Password or something. It's a speakeasy.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that phrase, however their programming is made, that unlocks whatever maybe Arnold programmed into them or Ford programmed into them. But again, I think in this episode we see that Dolores is frustrated with most everyone else but herself, and is killing off a lot of the hosts because, you know, they aren't meant to make it to the valley beyond.
I would say that Dolores is going to learn quickly. No man is an island, as she creates her own island, quite literally.
All right. Last email here is one of the shortest in the world from Ethan.
Do we know it's Ethan?
And salutations. Clementine sure was creepy. Have a good week. Love, Ethan.
Yeah, but that was his best email because she was creepy.
She was creepy.
Because she used to always smile.
Yes.
She was always happy.
Can I say, like, I'm kind of disappointed. I feel like not Ethan was more Ethan-esque than the actual Ethan this week. So, Ethan, I hope everything's okay in your world. I'm worried. Maybe some of your programming has gone off.
He set off Fartgate, so I think that's
was that his violent delights have violent ends. His
I fart think that's gate? It. Yeah,
Colonel.
A fart will do it. It'll trigger everything.
I'm glad that much like the
conjoined hexagons, we began and ended with a fart on this podcast.
Except instead of violent delights have violent ends, his was. He who denied it supplied it. But that is it for listener feedback. Gentlemen, any final thoughts on this episode before we close out the show? Or go to Jack's Crackpot Theory of the Week.
Crack fact.
Yeah, I was
going
to say, I mean, Jay and I have fortunately overshadowed Jack in the first part of this podcast by giving our own theories. So we'll see. Jack, you want to make it 3-for-3 here?
Well, your theories were okay. I was being nice.
Going back to that selective memory again.
Okay, so Jack, let's go to your crackpot theory of the week.
All right, so we see Grace, and we're all wondering, I mean, we all had the same, opinion when we were watching. We're thinking, is she a host? Is she real? Is she a host? I think she's real. You guys think that she works for corporate, right?
Grace?
That's what you guys, Grace?
Yeah.
I'm going to go one step. I think Grace, my first thought was that she was William's daughter.
Change your name from Emily.
It's fantasy world. And she's William's daughter, or I was going to even go one step further and say she was somehow Logan's daughter. But I think she's one of the two. She's related to either William or Logan. Well, I guess she'd be related to both since William married Logan's sister. But that's my crackpot theory. And I'm sticking to it. She's not just some person out of the blue.
I think that's a fair assumption.
So I think when all
but
said
didn't I say that? I think I said that in the earlier in the recap. I mean, not to crap on your theory.
No, you didn't say anything. Like you said, she worked for corporate.
Well, it would seem like it would be a waste for her to only be killed off that quickly.
Yeah. Well, I think we all agree on that. But
yeah,
I'm not saying she'd be killed off next week. I don't know.
Okay.
But I'm saying that she is. My first thought when I first saw her, the way she handled herself, I said, "Huh? She's got that book. She's writing things down. She's kind of got a plan." I go, "I bet you she's William's daughter." And then I said, "No, it'd be more fun if it was Logan's daughter because that just keeps Logan alive." But
I don't know if she'll get killed off next episode. I feel like, I mean, speaking towards the aforementioned Nikki and Paolo, I feel like I'm getting a very like Tailies vibe from her, you know, of like she was in a separate place, but she was experiencing very similar themes. Now she's crossed over. Hopefully she'll do better than most of the Tailies, considering what happened to most of them. But that's sort of the feeling that I got with Grace here, where I know I called a strand like the Martin Kimi of this season, but maybe Grace is like the representation of all the Tailies.
Yeah. No, I think that's a great observation. Is she the Ana Lucia or the
Ana Lucia dies.
That's what I'm saying.
I'm sorry, spoiler.
Echo, you had Ana Lucia.
Yeah, but, I mean, I think it's Bernard. Now the names really resonate. Because I think Bernard was the only Tailie who survived.
He is.
There you go.
The only Tailie who survived.
So she's really Bernard.
Wow, mind blown. Well, now that we like have this this like core mechanic, we could get a lot of literal brain swapping going on, right? And that also brings up some nice philosophical questions of, you know, if your soul is in a different body, is it you or is it somebody else? But I mean, now we have sort of opened that door as well of, you know, if this person's behaving in a certain way, is it this person or is it this person's, you know, memories and light bulb in their head?
Well, I think if they're acting the way the person, another person, that they're the other person.
So you think it's behaviorally speaking?
Right, yeah. That's what I think.
All right. Well, I think that is a good spot to close out this episode. If you'd like to give us a call at 385-309-0311.
Call anytime.
And if you'd like to give us an email, send it to westworldjjm@gmail.com. Ethan, the real Ethan, hope you're okay. It was a short email, threw me off this week.
Well, maybe he broke his fingers or
maybe
something.
Maybe he broke his finger. Maybe, I don't know.
Cut him some slack.
Maybe somebody gave him his violins, had violins, and she shifted here. I'm worried.
it's not easy coming up with gold every week.
I mean, Ethan, much better than Jack's crackpot theory. I got to say that.
Sorry, my theory will come true. You'll be like, okay, you're right.
You were right. You were right all along. Anywho, I want to thank some people, especially Tack from Tokyo, Eckhart Richter, Molly the Millennial, and the
I want to thank some people.
Yeah, you sounded very selectively judgmental there.
Like, you become Dolores.
I mean, that's one way. Yeah, that was one way to bring people into there by saying, like, look, don't be like, you can be those people or you can be those people and join the Patreon.
Yeah, I'd like to thank some people, but you know, some of those people. You're just not meant to be. So,
in fairness to me, I am about 5 hours of sleep. We had a great podcasting weekend, so I apologize for my nonsense.
No, listen, you busted out a kick-ass theory, in my opinion, on 5 hours of sleep. So again, let's refer to the notarized note on your wall, apparently by Jack, that said get less sleep more often.
But I'm starting to wonder if it was him or if someone is like influenced him.
Yeah, let's take that light bulb in your head.
Yeah, I'm starting to wonder.
There was there's nobody writing a script. There was no Lee writing a script in my head.
That you know of.
That's true.
You don't know. There was a lot of people there this weekend.
I could be on a track, and I don't know.
We're not doing this. There's no video here. I don't even know if that's you. Ethan could be hosting this show.
Yeah. Wait, Jay. If it's you, fart. That way we know.
No, well, fart and then, again, and then say, part, oh, that was some kind of computer thing going on.
No, I mean, part of that discussion
was a glitch.
They wanted Brian, who is a defense attorney, wanted to actually have all three of us fart into an audio file so that they could actually compare our different farting styles.
I think I could
just
fart on demand, or you think that's what I'm here for?
Well, they wanted real-world samples to try and figure out who was the fartee.
But my farts are different.
I have been so pleased to do so many insane things in the near 5 years that I've been podcasting. I will only fart into a microphone on command if I am subpoenaed to do so.
Oh, sounds like someone's got something to hide.
he will invoke his. I guess that's under the fifth.
I'll plead the fifth.
I have 5 hours
of sleep before a podcast. We just devolve into nonsense by the end of this hour and a half long Westworld podcast.
I do not have to fart on demand. That is my right.
Well, I mean, again, Mike, I don't know if that'll add to these conspiracy fires or not.
I think it's swayed towards Mike now.
The lady doth protest too much.
Oh man, Ethan, you see what you started? Okay. This show is listener supported, and we want to especially thank Tack of Toko, Eckhart Richter, Molly the Millennial, Ed the Letter Carrier, and Maggie the Magnificent, who was at our podcast get together this weekend.
That's awesome.
And all of the listeners that make this show possible.
All of you.
Join our Facebook group at facebook.com/group/JandJackGroup, where we have a bunch of TV show discussions. And that's where we do a lot of the planning and information around our kind of podcast weekend. We do it once a year. It's been the first week of May, the past first weekend in May, the past couple of years. It's a lot of fun. Chip and Sarah Mims, they do their own podcasts on The Americans, and Chip also does a fantastic beer-related podcast called Tales from the Cask. They host us at their beer distributor building, as well as we have a fun dinner at this fun Italian restaurant called Casa Carbone.
Excellent food. If you're ever in Raleigh, it's reasonable price and it's really good food.
So it's a fun weekend. A bunch of listeners come out and have a lot of fun, and we had a good weekend. Didn't sleep much, but it was a very fun weekend. And all the broadcasters were here this weekend. They did a live show, which I think Colleen has posted on their feed. Also, check out the Ramblecast. Matt from the Ramblecast was here.
I think he made it back because he drove down with Dan.
He did. He drove down with Dan. So I'm sure there'll be stories on this week's Ramblecast as well. I think that does it for this week's episode. Mike, you have a lot of things going on. Any updates that you want to share this week?
So doing podcasts as per usual about Survivor, RuPaul's Drag Race, SNL. For those of you that are fans of the Survivor historians, we have come out of our usual hibernation of every few months to finally do a podcast. We recorded that last night. Should hopefully be out in the next, 24 to 36 hours. So yeah, a lot of fun stuff going on to begin the lovely month of May.
If you're SNL SNL podcasting, how about Donald Glover this week? I thought he did a fantastic job both hosting and being the musical guest as Childish Gambino. But, every sketch I thought was great, and he just performed really well in his sketches where, sometimes you get the guests and they're kind of reading the cards or really aren't, nailing their timing. But he looked like he, rehearsed all those sketches, many, many times, to play it so naturally. But there's just a lot of funny stuff there.
Well, how much would you think was ad-libbed? I haven't watched it yet.
Nothing. Lorne Michaels is staunchly against improvisation because SNL is such a regimented show. They're really on. If you're talking about tracks, they have 6 days to put everything together. There really is no room to sort of make things up as they go along. But I mean, to your point, Jay, I won't belabor things too much because you can check out my opinions on the show overall, SNL Funhouse with the great Mario Lanza. But I mean, I've been a Donald Glover fan for the past 10 years since I discovered him doing Derek comedy on the OG Funny or Die. So it was fun to watch him go back to that. I think we sort of forgot about that between the Childish Gambino stuff and Atlanta, which you would call a dramedy because it's a half hour, but it's not. It's more speculative than funny or weird at the end of the day. But he really made things broader and goofier than back in those days with the Community and all that. So I totally agree. I'm a big Donald Glover fan, so I really enjoyed it, and I was happy to see Childish Gambino perform, considering I have his first CD on my iTunes. So it was good to watch just how much he's transformed as an artist over time. So you can check out all of our opinions on that, as well as Amy Schumer and Tina Fey coming up over on the SNL Funhouse podcast.
There you go. All right. That will do it. We'll see you guys next week. Hasta luego and goodbye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.